continue our deliberation on the trafficking law, but before we do that, I take it you've all, you haven't received copies. All right, I'm going to ask Bonani to distribute copies of the draft report on the Sexual Offences Amendment Act Amendment Bill.
Just a few issues. The reference to the act that we're amending, criminal procedure, it's the criminal law, Sexual Offences and Related Matters Act, not procedure.
Where are you referring to?
Paragraph 3 and paragraph 5. And then paragraph 5, the fourth last line.
It should be law, eh?
It's law, yes.
Right. Paragraph 5.
The one, two, three, third line, there must be an is there. The proposed section is already contained of the Act and therefore is not a new amendment.
Therefore is not, okay.
Now, Chair, maybe we can discuss whether we need the next sentence at all. The committee is of the view that it is not in a position to consider the merits of these objections at this stage.
All right, there's just a couple of other...
But that's... Yeah.
Language, it should read sexual offences and related matters, Amendment Act, then you close the bracket, Amendment Bill. No?
No, because that's referring to the previous act. This is...
Please put your mic on, Mr. Dupree.
Yeah, sorry.
The words Amendment Act should be inserted after the bracket.
After the bracket.
Okay. All right, sorry. I've got a couple of
things. Sorry, this is the bill that we're now doing is an amendment bill to that Amendment Act. I don't know where's the amendment bill part of it. Yes, at the top, right at the top, yes. Just then, as to whether we should... the sentence is relatively innocuous in paragraph 5. The committee is of the view that it is not in a position to consider the merits of these objections at this stage. I've got no major objections to it, but we've already said it's a repeat of what... When we talk about the 56A, it's merely a repeat of what... is in elsewhere, so just on reflection, I don't have an objection to the insertion of those words. We will consider it later if necessary, but that's all from my side, Chair. Going into, and I think maybe it is a wise approach not to go into pointing fingers at all or anything like that. The report is quite innocuous in that it doesn't say whether we agree with the Western Cape High Court or not. But it is important to note the speaker referred to this yesterday in his speech, this case, and it was almost a reflection on Parliament not doing its work. Now, we hold different views on that. The jury is still out on that. And until the SEA has given a verdict as to which judgment should be followed, it's perhaps a pity that the speaker created the impression. I don't know.
I think we should leave it in because it was part of the original bill that we proposed, 56A2, so I do think we need to explain why it isn't now there, because we've taken it out. And, you know, just to avoid public, they'll say we didn't consider it, whatever the objections. I think if it's no harm, there is no harm. I think it's better just for public relations purposes also to leave it in.
Yeah, I think I agree that... that sentence should stay in. Mr. Swart doesn't really seem to have a problem with it on reflection, so hopefully that can resolve that. My issue is that we have the two options of maximum penalties for each offence versus this general one. We opted for the general one on the basis that there wasn't enough time to consider penalties for each offence, but that would have been preferable and that should happen, and I think that should be then also in the report, that the committee would have liked to have tabulated specific penalties penalties for each offence that was created. Because I thought that was the route that we said this is short term, then long term that must happen. That was my understanding. It was on the basis that and it was in. We don't have time to do it now. It was an issue from. I mean, that was also Professor Birchall's view when I spoke to him. That this process should happen, and I think that we basically just indicate. We may not then need to say, I'm not sure what Debbie's objection is, we may not express that we would have liked to have done it, but we should say that we believe that this should happen and ask the Minister to report on that.
So to my concern is just that if we, I mean, I thought that what we're doing now is valid and legal or it isn't. My concern is if we're saying that we should rather have done this, then what we are doing now might be regarded as sufficient. But so if we read it carefully to the point of saying we would prefer to do that in future, then that's fine. But we must be just careful how we word that, not to convey any impression that we... I mean, I don't think we did say it's a stopgap, but I mean, it's either valid or it's not valid. If it's legal, it's legal. And we must just be careful we don't create that impression that it may not be.
The issue is, Chair, I mean, the bill is legal. Okay, the bill solves the problem. The question is that it would have been better to guide for judicial officers with the new statutory offences that have been created, for judicial officers to have some kind of guide as to how serious Parliament regards an offence. That was Professor Birchall's point. They don't have that at the moment. So when you've got, I can't remember all these different categories, and you've got to weigh up which one is more serious than the next one. I mean, that's the problem that we were grappling with. That's not a constitutional issue. It's just an issue that assists presiding officers. So it's not a issue of it's not constitutional. And we may want to put that in, that we would like to do this in order to assist judicial officers or courts, and we call on the minister to make proposals and report within a year.
The committee report, but I think Mr. Jeffries has covered what I was going to say. I think that if it's worded neutrally to request the minister to have a look at the need to and report back on findings of what we're talking about.
For that. I mean, look, there's going to have to be a motion suspending rules tomorrow because there's a three-day rule. And maybe that, I don't know. I mean, this is clearly a Section 75 bill, very, very clearly. Yeah. You know, Mr. Romano, follow that up. I was a bit surprised that the fact that we had finalised the bill was not reflected in the ATC today.
This being a committee bill, how does one expedite it through the NCRP process? Clearly one needs to link up with the committee there that's also doing it, and maybe have a word with the chairman on the select committee on justice or security, because it must also be expedited through that process.
Thank you.
because I need someone to formally move to the electoral report and then swap moves. All agreed? Mm-hmm. Any objections? No objections, thank you. That's done. I hope this is the last one.
Pretend.
You know, let's use it, but I wouldn't have, yeah.
Can I please raise a point of spelling?
That's not a point of
order. Paragraph number 3, 1, 2, 3, fifth from the bottom. It's not affected, it's effected. Otherwise it's fine, so don't I hate it.
So, okay, what do you say about anyone objecting to that?
What about gratitude?
Gratitude to pursue. Thank you.
Alright. Yeah, I mean, the sexual offences that propose in the government.
Proposed by Ms. Pilar Lemajak and seconded by Ms. Chester.
I'm volunteering you. And while we're on the judicial officers, I mean, with Chuck's claim in the church, but the official friend, how do you sort of get to her? I mean, that she's explained to me in the public and public.
Thank you, Chair. I just would like your guidance as to whether we should start right from the front of the bill or whether we should maybe go to clause 8 for Ms. Yeah. Last week we suggested some amendments to clause 8 to accommodate the submissions by MWEB and ISPA. There are further amendments that we suggest with the assistance of Mr. Roberts. So I don't know whether I can ask him to continue on clause 8, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Regarding clause 8, 8.2, well, let's rather start at clause 8.1c. I would propose that reference be made rather to internet service provider to an electronic communication service provider. So if any electronic communication service provider use electronic communications to facilitate or promote the trafficking of persons, all such electronic communication service providers should be brought under the ambit of the Act. Internet service providers is merely one type of service that can be used. You get into only cellular technologies that can be used. You get satellite technologies that can be used. You get cloud technologies, although one can argue that it is a kind of internet service that can be used for these purposes. So I would propose that we expand the applicability of that specific clause to all kinds of electronic communication service providers. Therefore, I would propose that reference be made to electronic communications and that the internet be deleted.
Mr. Roberts, can I ask you something, however? I mean, I think that is right, in as much as all licenses that used to be telecoms licenses if it came under the Electronic Communications Act, electronic communication service licenses, because that act is written to be technologically neutral, as all the new communications laws everywhere in the world are, except that broadcasting is still not. Broadcasting will also become an electronic communication service. But what worries me now is whether this might not be, in fact, too wide. Are we not really talking about services which provide access to the Internet? Now, I note in the submission from ISPA and MWeb that you finished last time that a new amendment is to be made in the Judicial Matters Amendment Bill, a new amendment, a new definition for Internet Service Provider, which will now read, means any electronic communication service provider who provides access to the Internet. I mean, is that not the salient point, the access to the Internet? Because are we not talking about websites and comparable phenomena? Isn't that what we're talking about? We're not really talking about anything else. We're certainly not talking about phone calls or text messages and the like. Phones themselves are relevant because they too give access to the Internet. But is this not now too wide?
The definition in the RICO is the current definition of RICO. There was a proposal that it be amended. You are correct. But RICO is written still in a technological classified manner. In terms of RICO, you will get fixed line technologies, internet technologies, and mobile cellular technologies. And the reason why there was a proposal that definition be amended was to just get rid of the current definition of internet service provider, which was so wide that it will actually also be applicable to parliament, each and every state agency, as well as my computer at home. According to that definition, if I provide access to the internet in terms of RICO via my own computer, I actually classify as an internet service provider. Maybe further on, do we make it too wide? Well, somebody once told me that communications, doesn't matter how it is delivered or distributed, it's actually the same where somebody takes a letter, rides on a horse, and drops it off at some other place. The medium or whatever can be transmitted, that can be transmitted, maybe differ in the outcome, maybe something like visual images in some instances. But the same can be, if you use something like words, the same objective can be achieved using words, not just images. If I place an ad on the internet will facilitate trafficking in persons, I cannot see why this cannot be done via SMSs. I can send bulky SMSs to, let's say, 1 million people. Mm-hmm. The same with the fixed line. I can call 100 persons to facilitate trafficking.
Mm-hmm.
So my submission is, why just restrict it to internet? Why don't make it? Why must it not be made generally applicable to all kinds of service providers? In any event, the electronic communication technology is advancing at such a pace that we don't know what services is going to be available tomorrow. Currently, there's something like satellite phones. You get integration of certain services like I can, via a fixed line, access my lockbox on the internet. I can send a fax from my cell phone. So, just to restrict it to the internet, it's my recommendation that will not be too wise.
Can I ask you a question? the rights, but also written technologically neutral now, because the particular technology used every new technology every 3 months is not the point.
It's a physical, it's not a physical thing, it's like a...
Mr. Chairperson, a cloud-based application is... Well, a good explanation of that, for example, will be maybe something like Wi-Fi. What actually happens is that there is a transmitter that places information in a specific geographical area. If you can access that geographical area, and if you are a client of that service provider, you would be able to access that cloud-based service, that server. Although it's got a technical name, one can probably in layperson describe it as an audio transmitter that transmits information in a certain circle, and if you enter that server, that circle, you will have access to that kind of communications.
Yeah, I mean, my worry with
the change from internet service provider to electronic communications service provider is that, I mean, we definitely know that the internet can be used as a vehicle to facilitate trafficking. And this clause is about steps to be taken to ensure that it's not not to be used, or to try and restrict it being used. And with the internet, there's, I mean, what is on the internet is generally, unless you've got a register for a site, accessible to everybody who goes onto that web page. My worry about making it wider is that, I mean, you know, so let's say it's a Wi-Fi service provider, a hotpoint or whatever, what's it called, a hot...
Hotspot.
You know, now... The responsibilities on that person who's providing a hotspot would be far less, because I mean it's radio stuff, far less than a internet service provider. So I'm worried that we are going too wide and not sufficiently focused. And then if you look at the definition of electronic communication service provider, a person who's licensed or exempted from being licensed in terms of the Electronic Communications Act. I mean, that's rather weird definition. You're licensed or you're exempted from, you're not licensed. The person who's licensed or doesn't have to be licensed. That's my worry. I would rather that we had a narrow approach on the internet service providers, ensure that we tackle them properly, and then move on to widening it.
Yes, absolutely. Look, I mean, the regulation of communications is economic regulation, okay? It's pro-competitive regulation. We're coming at it from a completely different discipline, and the reason why there are whole categories of communications licenses which we now allow to be exempt is that you want to free the field up for competition. We, like most other countries, come from a world in which there was one phone company transmitting over copper wires, twisted pair, and one broadcaster broadcasting over airwaves. And everything since then has been now the opening up to competition of these markets. Then the technology changed completely. You can do anything over any medium. So you write the technological neutrality. In order to give citizens more communications, more and more licenses are now no longer required at all. Does you got a license doesn't apply. If you are running a relatively small service, geographically measured, you basically just notify. You can't. That's what license is. So now I agree with the Honourable Jeffrey. It starts getting really awkward. Are you now imposing conditions or proposing the possible revocation, which is my real objection, of licensees who are anyway exempt, who only have to notify ICASA? It starts getting a bit crazy. What will save it is that we are going to require ICASA to do the regulation.
I mean, it really is not the kind of regulation they do. They do market analyses and do that anti-competitive regulation for dominant incumbents. This is way out of field for them. But I'm happier that they will then write any kind of regulation. But it really does start getting silly when you say people who are exempt from licensing are also part of the definition.
Chairperson, the definition was taken out of the Electronic Communications Act. It means that the Electronic Communications Act of 1965 provides for certain instances where a license is issued. And in terms of Section 6, it provides for exemption from being licensed. And so in terms of the Electronic Communications Act, I believe there's a general prohibition for a service provider to operate if he's not licensed or if he is not exempted from being licensed. Well, my submission is still, if you... Anybody thinks of the internet as a specific service that, well, I cannot actually differentiate between internet or any other service. It's like the internet provides you worldwide access. All other technologies can do that as well. What can, in most instances, be accomplished over the internet can also be accomplished over all the other technologies. Although, let's say I open a call box on my mobile cellular phone and allow access to that call box by, let's say, 50 other persons that can also contact that and get information from that call box. It works almost similar to that of similar to an internet functioning. So, but it's in the committee's hand to decide.
So, I don't understand why the problem is with someone who's exempted from getting a license, because if they're exempted from getting a license, doesn't mean they should be exempted from facilitating trafficking. So they can, you know, the purpose of the license is for the right to broadcast. If they have a right to broadcast, it doesn't matter whether they're exempt or not, they are broadcasting. Now, if they are facilitating trafficking via whatever they're doing, then I don't see why they should be exempt, and I think they should be included. And I do, I mean, I agree, I'm also concerned regarding confining it to internet service providers, because I can't imagine. If it's internet service providers or electronic communications, it's still going to affect us potentially and our home computer anyway, surely. But, you know, if we're only limited to internet service providers and then somebody establishes one of these cloud things, all you have to do is advertise it somewhere. You go on the tier of the password, you can access child pornography or whatever, you know, and they bring a whole lot of children traffic to South Africa or wherever they are and put it on the internet. On a special cloud where people have a pin to access it if they wish. So I am concerned that we're limiting it too much.
Thank you, Chair. I think in terms of the electronic service providers, making a provision for the electronic service providers, I would support that we actually leave it that way. But taking into consideration the fact that technology is advancing daily, even now when you're sitting here, you might find that there's something that is new that is coming in. We need to actually have a special provision that may actually then make reference to electronic communication, just to be sure that we cover anything that may actually come back in future. But also at the same time, the provisions that we're making here would actually apply to local companies, but there is a possibility also that international companies may actually manage to access South African citizens. And I think we should actually come up with a provision that actually manages to help us deal with that aspect.
I'm going to use back there.
It's a challenge here, but we need to take it into consideration as we try to draft law around this, because quite obviously it will have principles. We may actually manage to deal with South African companies, but when it goes beyond our borders, but still manages to access South Africans, what do you do?
The 1C, which is the advertising, printing, publishing, distributing, is for everybody. Okay, it's by use of internet or any other information technology. That applies to everybody. It applies to all these electronic communicators, so it's internet or any other. I would assume that information technology would relate to Wi-Fi, would relate to Bluetooth, would relate to bulk SMSs, and so on. So this thing of advertising applies to everybody under 1C. 2 relates to steps being taken to prevent the service being used for hosting or distributing the information. And that when the body, internet service provider or the e-communication service provider becomes aware, the steps that they must take. Now, I still have the concern that I mean, one, we're leaving it up to ICASA to issue. I mean, we had it as reasonable steps, which I actually preferred. We're now leaving it up to ICASA, which is not necessarily the right body to prescribe this. And so this is about, 2 is about prevention. 1C is about actually being used. 2 is about steps to prevent it and to become aware. And my fear is still, it's better to focus in on what we know as far as the prevention and the steps to become aware, rather than having it too wide, because distribution is covered by 1C. That's the So I'm still concerned with widening it, with widening 2, which would be 2 electronic communications. If it ends up being wide, it then becomes unimplementable, and it takes a long time to implement. And it would therefore be easier for, if one focuses on the internet.
As to what degree can you expect these people to go to police, and you can't, the fact that you can't. And we're going to stay with what is the standing law. Things are changing, but the standing law is that they're only a conduit. They must do notice and takedown procedures, and that about is about as far as you can go. And the only real issue for me here is I don't think it's any of our business just to go around revoking people's licenses.
Again, I will then proceed on the basis that
there are other provisions in the Act that will serve.
refer to the vocation of licenses, so we might have to look at that as when we get to those provisions.
Okay, we proceed then on the basis that we're only going to target internet service providers. It's limited then to internet. Clause 2 is then proposed to that independent communications, ICASA rather, prescribe certain steps. I think Mr. Jeffrey already raised certain concerns on that aspect. In general, ICASA is in control of the issuing of licenses in terms of the Electronic Communications Act. And they've also got, can, in terms of that act, make provision or rather impose certain obligations on certain persons that actually, to which licenses are issued. I think we had a similar situation in RICA, section 30, where although in that stage the Minister of Communications could impose additional obligations on internet service providers, to comply with the Act, and that has been done. So something similar to that can be done in terms of the bill or the proposed provision. Okay, the next clause.
Back on what we discussed last week. Is ICASA going to be able to do this? I mean, the internet service provider's concern was that it's too onerous. But the wording was reasonable steps. I agree. Just saying reasonable steps is not clear. It's up to the court. But is ICASA going to be able to prescribe exactly what they should have done? Are we right with ICASA rather than the minister? I'm not sure which minister. I mean, basically.
Please don't go the ministerial route. The ICASA is an independent regulator. For the purposes of broadcasting, which as things now stand is still separate, although technologically it isn't anymore, it is constitutionally independent. Section 192, only ICASA may regulate. Because the two are now all but indistinguishable, it is inevitable that at some point we will amend 192 constitution to call it not broadcasting but electronic communications. What you don't want is a minister being able to dictate anything to licensees. It is the job of ICASA to regulate. It's a rule-making body. It writes the regulations that apply to all comparable licensees. It issues the licenses. It imposes the license conditions, as Mr. Roberts has said. And the whole battle at all times is keeping communications ministers out of the terrain. As things stand, the communications minister has one or two final residual powers, but even then, they are powers, recommendations may be made, but they need only to be considered by ICASA because of its independence. And you really don't want ministers now imposing from left field conditions without being seized with the whole picture. ICASA is the right choice, but it's not what they usually do.
But it is the right choice because it understands the field in which it's working. It writes whatever regulations are applicable. I'm not sure to what degree it does any regulations for this kind of electronic communication service. The question Steve raised, right, the staff. They do for telecoms, they do for broadcasting. If anybody is, it is they.
Department. Well, then we put it in the resolution and we want to report back within 6 months from ICASA that the steps have been implemented. Surely they're accountable to us as Parliament.
Yeah, this is not conditions for getting licensed. This is steps that must be taken, and if you don't take those steps, you've committed a crime. Now, what's the situation with different types of pornography, child pornography, which presumably already would be laws against that. Who polices that? What steps do the internet service providers have to take to ensure that their internet is not used for, their ISP is not used for child pornography?
Jeffrey, I think that is in terms of the Films and Publications Act, probably Section 27, which, I think it's Section 27 of the Films and Publications Act, which places a general duty on them, on the service providers, in that case, internet service providers, and that specifically, I think, it relates to child pornography. If it becomes aware, or if they know that that such child pornography is being distributed, they must take certain steps. That is provided for in the Funds and Publications Act itself. It's like a general duty that's imposed on them in that regard.
But Chair 2A is about steps to prevent the services being used. I would imagine there's a similar provision relating to child pornography. What is that provision?
How does that provision measure up against Section 2A? Or vice versa?
Actually, Section 27.8.2 reads, if an internet service provider has knowledge that its service are being used for hosting or distribution of child pornography, such internet service providers shall then take reasonable steps to prevent access to that pornography.
That's not the point. They have knowledge already. I want to know, ours is not about having knowledge, it's reasonable steps, so regardless of knowledge, to stop anyone using it.
It takes, in terms of the section it's provided for in Section C, as such, internet service provider must take reasonable steps to preserve of this evidence. That's the only obligation that's placed upon them. And they must also report this to the South African Police Services. I don't think they've got a general purpose or a general obligation to remove or block any further access to that website. So it's mainly to preserve evidence and to report. That's the only obligation that's been...
So there's no duty on them to police?
No. Jeffrey, to police means that they must have access to the content of what is sent over the internet. If communications is sent over the internet, the service provider per se will not know what the content is. However, if they start to look at the content, they're actually contravening the RICO Act. That will be something like interception.
You and I can log on to that website and see that content.
It will also be...
It's the police's job.
But he's saying they're not allowed to do that. It's illegal.
Well, you just have to be different. European Union, you have to do it.
Well, you can in terms of recover, then you have to go to a judge and get interception direction, and then you can access the information. Otherwise, internet service providers will not look at the content of a communication. What will come over their server, or what is probably stored on their server, is something like the IP address from where it originated, IP address from to where it goes, and then something like the duration of the information that's sent over the internet to the other IP address.
Just to say one last question, I'll leave it.
What are these? Can somebody give me an example of what is a step? Give me an example of a step that must be taken under 2A. So the internet service provider will take all reasonable steps to prevent the use of its services for the hosting or distribution of information relating to trafficking, or the proposed amendment is as prescribed by ICASA. What step? Can someone give me an example of what steps are they going to be asked to take to prevent their services?
Mr. Joshua, I think certain websites might be may have been pre-identified as sites that are really in themselves to the distribution of, let's say in this case, information relating to the trafficking of persons. I think ICASA can probably place a kind of obligation on them that if there's communication to that site or communication from that site to an internet address in South Africa, that information needs to be blocked. It also relates to probably hosting of certain content on the system of the internet service provider. The internet service provider is usually bound by contract towards its customer. But I suppose that ICASA can probably impose some kind of obligation on them to maybe just make a pre-determined a scrutiny maybe of that site with the consent of the customer that it can be placed on the system to be hosted. That is just some steps that can probably be taken.
But then now, can I just sorry just yeah. That's 2A. But now, if you look at 2B3, so they become aware, and then they must, without delay, take such reasonable steps as necessary to prevent continued access.
Blocking.
Now, what's the you're talking when I said what steps would ICASA say they must take? You basically said ICASA would ask them to block access. Block communications.
Isn't that covered by 2B3?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Jeffrey, yes, I have to submit it's covered, but...
So then what's the point of
2A? Can I make some kind of differentiation? The first is it's a 2A. It relates to probably prescripts that can be imposed on them, how they must conduct their business to get rid of traffic-like information. The second part.
I want to understand what we're talking about in 2A. So not just prescripts. Give me some examples. The example. When I asked you for an example just now, you came up with blocking, which is covered by 2B3.
What about, for example, requiring that all service providers have to include a provision in their contract with anyone who deals with them that they will not use their facilities for these purposes?
Require these people to monitor the data they transmit or store. We've now agreed that
So any of...
What David is saying is, in the contract, you can make a provision whereby they agree that they're not going to advertise for shopping.
Who's that now? Everyone signs up for them?
Yes.
Every ordinary consumer?
No.
Who's the people to transfer this to? It's an ordinary consumer?
It can be an ordinary consumer, but the internet structure in South Africa works like that. You get something like 6 big internet service providers who actually sublease their services to other internet service providers, who again sublease their services to other internet service providers, and it goes on like that. To an extent, I think this can be controlled maybe through ICASA and put some kind of obligations in place if relating to traffic, if necessary. We can make it a discretionary clause in mutual perspective.
I'm thinking of the parallel with the Forms and Publications Act, where child pornography, a very serious offence, where a certain route was followed and it wasn't the policing, it was once you have the information. Now we're taking it a step prior and we're trying to bring in the policing with this. So maybe we should, why are we going this route if it's so difficult to enforce? Should we not follow what we did in the Forms and Publications? And then we've got the kick in. Once you take knowledge, you've got on page 18, the steps there, it follows what's in the Forms and Publications Act. Or alternatively, I've put in here, if necessary, under 2A, must take steps as are prescribed where necessary. Because the ICASA might say, but it's not necessary. They might say, but we don't, in their appeal, we'll spend days and days on this. This is an area we don't know. So I would suggest that if we want that route, which I don't necessarily follow because I'm so aware of the issue of the Forms and Publications Act, child pornography being massive, they decided then in their wisdom not to police it, but to say when it becomes knowledgeable to you, this is what you must do. Understanding that it is very difficult to police it. Maybe that's the route to follow. Alternatively, if not, then we put in a discretionary clause here, only where necessary, if it ICASA thinks it's necessary to prescribe.
I think we're trying to do something which is not resolved. The principles as they stand now are in the ECC law. These people are mere conduits. When somebody discovers something on a website or on the net that is visibly illegal, they send in a notice and the ISP takes down, and they're protected against liability for wrongful takedown. Those are the principles now. We all know that an awful lot of bad stuff is happening using electronic communication. And I think that those principles are in fact going to change, but it's going to be quite, I mean, it's already beginning to happen. But that's the law as it stands. Until that is amended by people who are really expert in knowing what can and can't be done, I don't think we should try to do anything adventurous here. Those amendments will come, and I think quite soon the ECT Act needs amendment in many, many ways. Communications is going to amend it. I don't know which clause is, but this whole field is changing. Mark Hain, who often sits with Hain Cipria and the Honourable Jeffrey and I on the particular personal aspect, is particularly an expert. These things will change, but I think this is not now the place. I think we have to stay with what we know can be done. And I think we should reaffirm, as we have done in this now new 5 and B, that nothing in the section places an obligation on an ISP to monitor the data which it transmits or to actively seek facts or circumstances. And then for me, the only remaining issue is this revocation of license, which I don't like. But I don't think that we should try to invent ways of protecting citizens in a law like this. Wait until the principles actually change.
Mine is that I'd like to know, I mean, I hope nobody would challenge me if I equate child pornography and trafficking. So what I would like to know is, what is the regime for the internet service providers? What is the regime to prevent and deal with child pornography? And should we then not have the same regime? Maybe it would be useful, I mean, Mr. Roberts has given us some verbal examples. Maybe it would be useful just getting a page, written page, on what is that regime. Because I would be worried about, I would say it should be the same regime, so that it's not a confusion of when it comes to child pornography, you have to do A, B, and C. When it comes to trafficking, you've got to do A plus, B minus, and C3. So that relates to particularly 2A and B.
The ISPA does association, and if you want the NWIB as well, but ISPA covers them all. For their comment on how the South Korean regime, as you described it, is working, I deeply distrust the Pullman and Publications Amendment Act. I deeply, deeply distrust it. It does all sorts of unconstitutional things. And I myself would like to be satisfied that it also doesn't try to do frankly unworkable things before we travel the details of duplicating what they did there. I know that that man who ran that board, unfortunately, or maybe for that, did a lot of traveling and studying in Europe to see what they were doing. So he would be not uninformed. But I just do not like what they did in that act, and I would hate to follow this example if it isn't workable or acceptable. Could we ask the ISPA for their comment on that?
As we are trying to finalise this bill, I think Mr. Swart has said, look, we don't have to follow what is in Film and Publication. But Mr. Swart, I would have thought, would have made Ms. Smuts happy by saying that they had decided not to require policing of the content.
But then you might be unhappy about the next week if
what we had is the original goal we took from the Films and Publications Act, Section 27A, and we do the same provisions as it relates to pornography as it should be here. Hosting or distributing or in any manner contributing to such internet access to a police official of the South African Police Service and paragraph C, take all reasonable steps to preserve such evidence for purposes of investigation and prosecution by the relevant authorities. And then paragraph 3, an internet service provider shall, upon request by the South African Police Service, furnish the particulars of users who gain
what?
Who attempted to gain access to an internet address that contains child pornography. And then the offence provides any person who fails to comply with subsection 1 shall be guilty of an offence and liable on conviction to fine or imprisonment for a period of dot dot dot. And then any person who fails to comply with subsection 2 B shall be guilty of an offence and liable upon conviction to fine or imprisonment for a period not exceeding 5 years, which is both such fine and imprisonment.
So you see, that's section 1 that was read now. Did they really think you could make an internet service provider registered with the Film and Publication Board? It's the same, this is the same Amendment Act which requires everybody to submit everything you're about to publish for prior restraint, pre-publication censor. It matters. Do they think you can expect the ISPs, they must now register with the censorship board, please? And may I just have clarification, does it say that you read that what was the policing provision there? The ISP must report to the police anybody using it's a form of interception.
RICO Act provides that interception may also take place in terms of other legislation. How I see this, once the site has been identified and it has been categorized as a site that contains child pornography, the internet service provider is actually under an obligation to provide records of persons that probably access that site. This can also be an instance where an internet service provider actually hosts the information on his site. The child pornography site is actually on his server. And it's then taken down, but persons that access that can be reported to the police.
Back to our original wording, must take all reasonable steps. And must take all reasonable steps, and then we've got the, once they become aware of the information, then B, C kicks in.
In the internet service provider's concern was that the original wording was so onerous on the, that was just what they were saying. No, wait, let me finish. That it was so onerous. But now, they already had that duty in terms of the Films and Publications Act. Then I'm not sure what they were complaining about.
I think they're just pushing our buttons. And all they do, trust me, they do. They do.
being inserted, which goes a long way to alleviate the burden. My suggestion, Chair, is that we go back to the wording, must take all reasonable steps to prevent the use of its service, take out as are prescribed by ICASA, and we've got sub 5 that limits what they have to do. They are not required to police. They need to only take reasonable steps, bearing in mind what sub 5 says. And I think that covers it.
And for the rest, you'll never come aware of
that. Yes, yes. Put that in as an option and come back to that. Or finalize. We can finalize it. Let's finalize it.
There was a new proposal whether this whole thing shouldn't simply be subsumed into 11.4 at the bottom of the page, footnote 21, since 11.4 already deals with licenses, and I was hoping for some illumination from you on what 11.4 means and what the other licenses are. People's licenses, and I'm just curious to know what they are.
I wonder if you explain to us what the 11.4 is seeking to do?
Yes. If we look at offence of trafficking, it doesn't apply only to individuals, but it will also apply to juristic persons, for example. So, for example, a recruitment agency. So, if an employee of a at a recruitment agency was involved in the trafficking of a person, then 11.4 will then apply in this instance. Sections 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 14. These all appear
Aren't you talking about the license that has got to do with internet services? And I must actually say that the idea of revocation of the license, for me, even if it actually sounds drastic, I think it's very good because it then becomes a deterrent. Because, you know, the intention of the act is that it actually encourages the service providers not to engage on what is contentious that you're actually trying to cover in the act. Because in some areas we talk about having knowingly done something, take reasonable steps. Even just that area of having to take reasonable steps, how you would actually also define reasonable steps, I think to some extent would be a challenge. And this is why, therefore, I think if people or service providers know that there will be finally drastic action that will be taken, that in itself would actually enforce compliance with the law.
Well, in the case of law which deals with carriers, yes, that's a ship, container ship.
Okay, boats and trucks, I can see it with trucks now.
Boats and trucks, yes. The boat must be registered, so.
Or principal has contravened section 4, 5, 6,
yes.
7, 8, 9, 10, serves as a ground for the revocation or cancellation of any license or registration that the employer has. Now, you know, that, I mean, that sounds quite sweeping to me. If you're including boat ships, I mean, boats, how do boats get licensed? Don't they get licensed in other jurisdictions?
Yeah.
For our ports.
Yeah,
so that's a different thing from revoking a license.
The way to do with it is a discretion, Chair. Put under sub C in each case may. It's may, and it's a standard clause in many clauses. If you are infringing a bylaw, a business bylaw, then the court can refer that to the licensing authority and say, in this case, this has happened, and the licensing authority may review the license. It's not, maybe we've said must, yeah, but maybe we just say may. It gives the licensing authority the power to look at it in its discretion. No, and that doesn't, but we should say under C, possibly give them the discretion. It's a may.
Yes,
for all
what
I know.
What authority do we have to tell, for example, animal?
Yes,
that's my question. Because the yes boat, it carries these containers, container load of girls. Now, they're caught here in Cape Town. The ship is registered in Panama. Can you tell Panama to revoke the registration of the ship?
Why should we not?
If we're not even saying that at the moment, Chair, we're saying they must review it.
Must review it. They
not
must review the license.
But, well,
we're
just saying may review.
They'll sit there and review and say, no, we don't get
so. I mean, with a great respect, I thought, I understand how boats are part of what you're dealing with. I still don't know what the other sections deal with. But, I mean, the licensing or registration regime for any of a range of other things might work in ways which are not understood or anticipated in a law like this. It might be a completely stupid thing to be saying that their licenses should be revoked. There are all sorts of considerations in play. All I'm only saying that I don't think it makes any sense to revoke electronic communications licenses. And I'm not sure to what degree, but it's now, thank you, I haven't been involved. It's relevant in section 4, 5, 6, 7, 9, and 10.
Pardon my ignorance, Chair. I'm actually thinking that we're trying to actually put together legislation that will be applicable to a South African situation. Because the minute we start talking about Panama and utilizing that on business that is outside the jurisdiction of South Africa, doesn't that complicate? Unless that is actually being, the act is being committed within the boundaries of South Africa. And also in terms of international relations, also to a large extent also I think what needs to be taken would be in some instances diplomatic immunity. But I think what is important at the end of the day when it comes to South African laws is that they begin to apply to the South African situation in terms of the provision of the South African constitution.
Look, I firstly I think that 8.4 is covered under 11.4. So I think it could come out at 8.4. And then it obviously we need to make a distinction between, and even with the clerk in writing notify the authority, that this must be, it needs to be South African authorities, I think. You can't expect the clerk of the court to write to the Panamanian shipping authority, and the same with internet service providers. I mean, if it's a foreign domain, nothing that can be done. And you can't have a duty on that. But if it's a South African registered domain, then yes. And I don't have a problem with a may revoke issue, but they must consider it at least.
And you need the may revoke,
particularly. I mean, it's just easier with like an aeroplane. Let's say they do negligently allow for a couple of trafficked people as passengers. You can't force the whole airline license to be revoked just because of that. You might say if you do it again, and I suppose the same would apply to ISPs as well.
See, I don't know why we're even talking about Panamanian ships. I mean, the extraterritorial jurisdiction can only apply in terms of COL to citizens resident of a republic, juristic person for partnership registered in a republic. So what is the relevance of the union?
So we're taking out 8.4, Chair. We're keeping our new 5. We are reverting to the taking of meaningless steps, but we do require them to report, which means something, and to preserve, which might mean something, and we do require them to block. Isn't that right?
Just for purposes of us going back and redoing this check, so I just want to recap what we're supposed to do. So we're going to stick with internet service provider, and we're not going to have the reference to any electronic communication service provider. In 2A, we will keep the original wording that we had. No. With regard to, okay, clause 8.4 will be deleted because it's already covered under clause 11. With regard to 11.4b, we will just make sure that we have the South African authority and not just the work authority. And in C, there must become a May.
Chairperson, maybe just another, from my side, a recommendation. No, it's not. It's, in terms of a takedown notice, I believe the internet service provider that takes down the notice is absolved from liability. I think a clause should be inserted under, under 2, maybe it's 2C that has got a similar, that is similar to that. Electronics communication service providers are usually quite scared. On one hand, they face civil litigation if they do something, on the other hand, criminal penalty if they don't. In the context of this act, rather absolve them from civil liability. But also ensure that they more readily comply with the Act in this regard. Yeah, it's in the ECT. It's actually in, I think, 1773. They deal with the takedown notice. I propose something to the following internet service providers not liable for any lost damage caused by a person as a result of any bona fide action taken in terms of B3. I've actually asked him to block.
My apologies, but I'm still confused. If you have a look at page 17 of the document, I think that was an amendment that was agreed to last week, that an internet service provider that is aware or becomes aware, that will stay there. And then we had a query or inquiry about the internet address on its service, which we changed to of any electronic communication instead of referring to an internet address. If you could put the clarification on that, please.
Sorry, that relates to if we use the broad term electronic communication service providers. Electronic communication service providers, but if it only relates to the internet, then the internet address, it should go back to that.
Going back to the internet address, yeah. Okay. So the electronic communications identity number comes out.
On page 80, on top of the Roman fee, that was also, as suggested last week, take such reasonable steps as are necessary to preserve evidence as may be required by the relevant investigation and prosecuting authority.
Yes.
And then 3, without delay, take such reasonable steps as are necessary to prevent continued access to that internet address. I presume that the amendment will come out there.
Yes. So A, A, and B come out. electronic communication.
No, I just think that look, my problem with my original problem with widening it to electronic service provider, communication service provider, was particularly relating to and the steps that we required ICASA to make by way of regulation, and I was worried about the focus of that and everything getting lost. However, if one looks particularly, now we're taking that out as far as I know, this requirement for ICASA to do regulations. If you go to B, I actually now on reflection don't have a problem with widening that electronic communication service provider. Because if, for example, a Bluetooth service provider becomes aware that their facility is being used to transmit messages relating to trafficking, then they should have a duty to report to the police and so on. So my problem with the widening it originally was particularly relating to 2A and this requirement that ICASA have make regulations, and I wasn't sure, I was worried that your other electronic communications providers, you know, the whole focus on the internet, which is a prime area, would be lost. We've now changed that, and there is a duty under B, which if you restrict it to internet service provider, it is then possible for other people to escape.
Just in B.
Well, particularly B, yes. Particularly B, seeing one has. Well, look, yeah, I mean, I think particularly B, the should be electronic communication service provider. A probably could still be internet service provider, although I don't know if that's going to over. We have changed A now to make it just more or reasonable steps to prevent the use. I mean, I don't have a problem with the problem was this requirement on the ICASA to make regulations for Wi-Fi or everything else, and that's gone.
Are you okay with that?
Can we make it right to the back? Apologies, sorry.
Why would we not be interested under A just for consistency? Is it going to make any difference? Because you're going to refer under A to internet service provider, under B, you made the suggestion.
Yeah.
Is there any,
yeah,
just for consistency, yeah? What do you think? Agreed. Electronic communication service with apologies from the Honourable John Jeffries.
And apologies to me, you forgot to laugh.
Just throwing a clip in your box.
Let's move on. Are you informed that T, where's T, you're talking about, so we're not waiting for T.
Then why not? We need a break.
We need a break. I just confirm what you need to know, that you're going back to the use of
internet service providers.
Stan is going to shoot us any minute now. that included in 2A as well?
Mr. Chairperson, after the team, maybe I need to discuss certain definitions that we propose if we make an electronic communication service provider.
Let me just carry out this point from this statement, being very patient with us. So, do we have that?
I believe so. All
right. Can we break for
6 months?
10 minutes.
I may be just mistaken, but under clause 8, the ought reasonably to have been almost suspected. I mean, this is a criminal provision. Now, what we've learned is that, because I just did it this semester, and it's still refreshing my mind, but we're told that when you're looking at criminal provision, reasonably more than you don't know beyond the role of what you say, because in that person's perspective, in that person's position,
it has come into our law in all of other cases already. It's been there for some time, terrorism, things like that. But I don't think the reasonable man is just leaving. When you look at when does culpable homicide become murder? Intention so much, but because I mean, let's take the reckless and negligent driving case resulted. Let's take Juju's case. Okay, he never wanted to kill those people, but he's up for murder because they're arguing that he should have foreseen.
Yes, in his position.
In his position, yes. But it would also be, wouldn't it be elements of objectivity?
I'm told that even, in fact, it's important for a magistrate to say this person should have foreseen, well, not this person, he should have foreseen that in these circumstances, the agency should be when he was doing this
particular. But how do you measure what? How do you measure it? You have to measure against a reasonable person. A reasonable person would have foreseen this. Therefore, you should have foreseen it. He then has to argue, no. Even though a reasonable man might have foreseen it, he didn't because he was blind in one eye.
But even if
I'm just coming at it from a different angle, and that is that okay, he should have foreseen it because a reasonable man would have foreseen it. Okay, maybe that this would happen, and therefore he's got the necessary intention. Because he should have foreseen it as a reasonable man. He then has to argue that then the onus becomes on him to say, okay, even though a reasonable man might have foreseen it, he didn't foresee it for these and these reasons. But anyway, it's not new, it is in the law. It is in the law already. I think it's been there for the last 10 years. Maybe it hasn't come up in terms of being tested in the court, but
I'm going to have it from the world.
I know you're a prosecutor, and I'm a very keen criminal law student. Yes, I love it. I was just
do what?
Criminal law. Yes, I was just asking Mr. Jeffrey this just now. I'm looking at this.
This is a your problem, yeah.
Yes, and you deal with this issue. It's a criminal law profession. Now, what we've been taught now is that. I mean, they've got to have what reason to have
them. Dollars in the
church. But now, we're told that when you're looking at it, when you're looking at it, in criminal law, you can really expect it's subject and not what you and that it's incorrect from the side of the research to say that he should have foreseen or should have known that it is in his position under the circumstances that he found himself he should have isn't this bringing in elements of objectivity?
Yeah, I mean, subjective in which sense? You say he accused me. He is in the accused position.
Yes.
Taking into account the level of education.
Yes, exactly.
And then that's when you can say, but if it's somebody else who is just.
But isn't this so
reasonable?
So, I'm just trying to find out, I think this is objective.
A way of doing
subjective.
You can say it's subjective because once something is objective, it applies to everybody.
To everybody.
And but when it's subjective, it applies to a certain class. You, somebody like you. I will say, should have posted it.
In my question, and you're saying this, and this is saying that.
Yeah,
it's saying that. It's limiting you to that person. Okay, so it is
objective
to everybody. Yeah. So this one is objective in line with.
Oh, okay, all right. Okay.
It's still the same. We still have to know the lesson from
my professor was in my mother studied in Germany. He preferred to apply to the law test.
I know.
And then the theory consistency.
And when constitutional elements now come in,
they are raised after the trial. Normally, if they say a certain offense is unconstitutional, then it goes to the Constitutional Court or the High Court and say you are in the regional court. If you go to the High Court, if the High Court feels it should be fair to the
back to the previous position. I propose that certain definitions be inserted. I believe an electronic communication service provider in the draft that's put before the committee is defined with reference to the Electronic Communications Act. Since we're not only going to target the internet address but also any other electronic communication address, I will propose that something called electronic communication identity number rather be used in its place. It has been defined in the drafts that was submitted to the committee.
Yes.
I can say that this actually comes out of the Protection of Harassment Act.
Okay.
And then I will probably also propose that electronic communications be defined, and we can probably look at a definition similar to that as contained in the Electronic Communications Act, namely it says that it means the emission, transmission or reception of information, including without limitation voice, and it then sets it out. It's contained in the Electronic Communications Act. It's similar to that. We can just take that definition over and set it in this bill there.
Which says any person who blah blah concludes a forced marriage with another person
for the purpose of the exploitation of that child or person. Okay? So you can come across marriage for the purpose of exploitation. You then look at the definition of exploitation, which includes various things, one of which is sexual exploitation, which I would say is probably the most common for a horse man. Now, if you look at the definition of sexual exploitation, it specifically refers to somebody who has, against whom a sexual offence has been committed, but that person is a victim of trafficking. So it seems to me that you then have to first be, as whatever the word is we use, certified as a victim of trafficking before you can be forced into a marriage for the purpose of sexual exploitation. And I'm not convinced that's what we were intending, because what I see here, forced marriage for the purpose of exploitation is itself an offence in terms of this. And it's going to not necessarily be the case if we also have to, provided they have to be a victim of trafficking. My suggestion is that we remove the word against the victim of trafficking. I also raised other issues regarding, when I discussed it informally with him, regarding the other grounds for exploitation, slavery and servitude and whatever. You know, are those, whether that requirement is not part of the definition, but if the legal people could perhaps tell us where in the Act those are used and whether there is some kind of context which limits them to that.
Let's deal with the first issue, please. Yes, okay.
Yeah, I'd like to also get my head around this, and on first reading, it seemed that sub 2 on page 14 creates a separate offence of either adoption or forced marriage. Then you look at exploitation, and exploitation, it includes slavery, sexual exploitation, or servitude. So forced marriage could be slavery, sexual exploitation, or servitude. Then the shaper refers to the one part which is sexual exploitation, which then links it to a victim of trafficking. If you take out victim of trafficking, it impacts sexual exploitation throughout the book, which could have a negative connotation. I understand the concern for this particular issue, but now if you remove victim of trafficking, then what we are creating here is a separate offence which deals with illegal adoption of within borders or forced marriage within borders that has nothing to do with trafficking, which is something that we might want to do. I'm not opposed to that, but the formulation as we've got it now limits it to victims of trafficking, and her concern is genuine, because then victim of trafficking needs to be so certified. So there is that concern, and maybe the legal advisors can just have a look at the implications of this. I also looked, because exploitation refers to the definition of slavery. Slavery is in itself defined in the bill, and it's only referred to in the definitions. So there are one or two legal implications for this point. Maybe, I don't know if we'll be able to finalise it today, maybe they should just look at it and see if there is a concern, and what would be the implications if we remove the words victim of trafficking under the definition of sexual exploitation. Because remember, that is the crucial definition around this whole bill. We spent a lot of time, right, starting with exploitation and then to sexual exploitation, and we had a very complex definition of sexual exploitation referring to the Sexual Offences Act and various others, and then we took all that out and we said we're only going to use the word sexual exploitation and link it with the victim of trafficking. So I'm not I would like us as the legal advisors just to advise us, is there a concern, and there might well be a valid concern that Ms. Schaefer raises. One last point, if you take out the words victims of trafficking, then all the services that are linked throughout the bill refer to victims of trafficking get these services, victims of trafficking get these services. So,
that's because this is just referring to the definition of sexual exploitation. Victims of trafficking will still be victims of trafficking.
I didn't see Ms. Schaefer's point as stopping the requirement of certification of a victim of trafficking. What I'd like to know is can somebody just take us through why was it necessary for sexual exploitation to be only committed on victims, certified victims of trafficking?
Chair, I think when we look at a definition of sexual exploitation as well as the definition of exploitation, we should read it together with the offence of trafficking. The offence of trafficking is quite clear against whom the offence should be committed. So whether or not one actually has the word victim of traffic against victim of trafficking at the end of the definition of sexual exploitation does actually not matter, because it's already covered in terms of the offence against whom it must be committed.
I noticed that exploitation is not it's not limited to being against a victim, a certified victim of trafficking. Forced labour is not doesn't have that restriction either. So it does seem a bit odd that sexual exploitation has to be against a victim of trafficking.
If we could maybe just get them to go through the bill and just make double sure that there aren't any other indications for any of the other sections, then it would make more sense to remove it, I think.
Can we do that? So we'll flag that.
Would you like me to go through the bill from the first page? All the footnotes?
Yeah, the, you know, just things that we need to do that we'll look at. we've covered this whole morning, we've covered what was important in terms of clause 8, but is there anything else other than what we've looked at in clause 8?
There's still some options in respect to some of the clauses and maybe the amendments. Maybe if we could just do any amendments that we still have to consider as well as options.
Chair, the option is spelled out a lot more detail. And there is the provision that's not in the original, that if the visa may be
extended or
withdrawn.
I think the difference also in the first one is that it says is needed by and has agreed to cooperate, whereas the option says victim of trafficking if that person is present and has agreed in writing to cooperate with law enforcement authorities. I mean, you know, I might agree to comply and they don't want me. Then I get to say, is that covered? And if the NDPP in writing confirms, okay, well, sorry.
Looking at the option on page 26, subparagraph D, the committee must just guide us on the wording of that paragraph. The Director General Home Affairs may, despite paragraphs B and C, or we can use the word the provisions of this subsection, and then decline the issuing of all. Refuse the issue of visitor's visa or the extension thereof, if there are reasons to do so.
What about despite the provisions of this subsection, in case at any point any others may be added, rather than limiting it to specifics, and then refuse to issue? No.
If I can take you back to page 25, the heading of clause 16. We will also see that we have an option there, facilitation of police investigation or prosecution, or facilitation of police investigation or prosecution in case of foreign witnesses. If you could have the committee's guidance. On page 27, there is the option 1, as well as on page 28, option 2, in the case of clause 17.
Made by the victim, isn't it? And therefore, isn't option 2 better, that the National Commission or the NDPP may assist us rather than they do the application on the behalf of the person?
Person on page 30 with regard to clause 19.
Yes.
You will note I've got a footnote there, number 53, with regard to 19.1a. The question arises whether the wording of clause 19.1a should not be aligned to the corresponding wording in clause 18.1a, which deals with child victims. The following wording is tabled for consideration. Despite any law, policy or code of conduct prohibiting the disclosure of personal information, any person who knows or ought reasonably to have known or suspected that an adult person who he or she comes into contact with during the execution of his or her duties is a victim of trafficking must immediately report that knowledge or suspicion to a police official for investigation. I don't think there's something wrong with the current wording, but it's just for uniformity.
Specifically, we're concerned that that's not to be applicable to legal practitioners.
So we're going for what is in the footnote, Honourable Members?
Yes.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
So I must apologize if I could take you back to page 23, footnote 27. With regard to clause 15.1, despite the provisions of the Immigration Act, the Director General Home Affairs may in the prescribed manner and subject to the prescribed conditions issue a foreigner in respect of whom a report has been made to police official as provided for in section 18 or 19. Now, section 18 deals with children. The question arises whether children are intended to be included for purposes of a recovery and reflection period. Initially, the bill intended for child victims to fall under the protective measures of the Children's Act. Therefore, previous clause 14 and at some stage it became clause 17 provided for the process to be followed when a child victim of trafficking is found in the Republic. Clause 43 provided that the finding in terms of section 156 of the Children's Act that an illegal foreign child who is a victim of trafficking is a child in need of care and protection serves as authorization for allowing the child to remain in the Republic for the duration of the Children's Court order. And the committee might wish to consider retaining the above provision to provide specifically for children to remain in the Republic. I think that the old clause 14 is found on page 34 of this document.
Sub 3 of on page 34, and that's where the finding links the authorization for allowing the child. Is that what you think we want to bring back?
That's correct, sir.
It sounds reasonable, Chair, that 14.3 in some formulation bringing it back, because there could well be if we don't, then there's could be a lacuna where that child. The authorization for allowing the child to remain at the top of 35, that is nowhere to be found in the Act. We've taken it out.
Okay.
I think it sounds a positive suggestion.
What if they in 15?
15, one, wherever it fits in properly from a drafting perspective.
Probably. No?
I mean, the recovery and reflection period is to a person, a victim of trafficking, to allow them to decide what to do. Okay?
Providing
assistance to the police. I think that's quite different to the issue of illegal children. No, they shouldn't be. I mean, I think it's important to understand that it's a different regime. You know, they get reported to I think, as far as I understand the regime, is they're reported to the social workers, to the children's court. I agree with the provisions of 14.3 if they have disappeared. They can't anyway be returned in terms of the existing provisions of the Children's Act. If an assessment hasn't been done that it's safe for them to be returned, all those kinds of things. So there's an entirely different regime for children. I don't think they need the recovery and reflection period. It's
authorization.
Have we provided for what is in 14, the old 14.3?
Mr. Chairperson, no, I don't think that it was removed. The only provision of the old clause 14 is in the clause 18 dealing with child victims of trafficking. And sub clause 7. So I would suggest that we see whether we could fit that the old provision of the old 14 also in there.
So that it goes into somewhere in clause 18. All right. 18, probably after sub 7. Is that okay?
Okay.
All right, Mr. Sir. Speaker's speech yesterday. He's doing a good job. About admonition, yes. Well, let's look at ourselves first, Mrs. Schiffer. Okay. All right. This is stained on my last week.
Mr. Chairperson, the following is on page 47, sub clause 3, 31.3. It's a new clause, a sub clause. If the Director General Home Affairs decides not to repatriate the person after consideration of the factors provided for in the referred section, that Director General may, and then he would also ask the guidance of the committee, may on behalf of that person, or should it only be that person who must apply to the Minister of Home Affairs to grant that person the rights of permanent residence for a specified or unspecified period?
Mm-hmm.
He's already refused. The DG, I beg your pardon. The DG has already refused. An appeal mechanism.
I understand this, if Dr. Singh correctly says, if the Director General decides not to repatriate, that there is an altered consideration of the factors provided for in subsection 2A, 1, 2, 3.
Yeah.
No,
it's not their blame. It's in the safety of the person. So the Director General decides not to repatriate the person because it is in that person's safety considerations. Therefore, why shouldn't the Director General assist that person? Why don't we have the Director General or that person apply to the Minister of Home Affairs? So it's either because that person might be in such a state that they can't do it themselves. So why should it be one or the other? Maybe it could be both. Is there any reason why it couldn't be both?
I think it sounds strange that the DG, this is, I mean, the requirement is there for children, which was there in the Children's Act, okay, and that's done by the DG of Social Development. But sub 3 on page 47 becomes a bit weird, where it's the DG of Home Affairs must apply to the Minister. I mean, it doesn't make sense. But I mean, doesn't the DG grant the application? I would have thought that the 3 should come out. I mean, it leaves it open. But given the sort of, I don't think it is a lacuna that what happens to a person Home Affairs were happy with the rest of the section, that the DG may not repatriate the person. But I think let it, in fact, both of them, why do we want to be and be relating to children and 3? It's 31(1)(a) is may not repatriate the child. No, wait, let me finish. But the problem is that the social development repatriate children. Yeah, but it's basically the child may not be repatriated. But then with the adults, it isn't it sufficient just to say the DG Home Affairs may not repatriate, because it is Home Affairs who repatriate a child who's a victim. I mean, an adult who's a victim. I'm talking about 31(2) now, and that is it. And it's up to them to decide what they want to do. So I really don't think we need 3. Relating to permits. And with 31(1), I similarly don't think we need the B. But my worry just with 31(1) is it's not social development that repatriates.
So just with regard to 31(1) regarding repatriation by social development, this was a provision that has been discussed with social development on many occasions, and they specifically requested that they want to be responsible for the repatriation of children, given the fact that they are also responsible for child protection in general.
Yeah, that's fine, but what's then stopping, you leave 31(1) as it is, what then stops some child getting put on a plane by a Home Affairs official? 312 only applies to adults. So that's what I'm trying to correct. I mean, I'm glad social development wants to assume responsibility, but at the moment I would see it as what we're basically saying is or the intention is that there has to be this investigation and it should be more onerous for a child. And anyway, this is already in the Children's Act. What's in the Children's Act? Social development. All right.
Can we just say no foreign child may be repatriated? No foreign child who's a victim of trafficking may be repatriated.
Can't they exercise their rights in terms of the Children's Act? You mind, Imogen?
Not yet. I just wanted to indicate that we probably need to look at the Child Welfare, Child Care Act, to see what provision has it got in terms of children who need to be repatriated, because the Act must talk to each other, so that you don't come up with a new provision that contradicts what is in the Child Care Act. Normally, for a child like this, in terms of the Child Care Act, you might find that the child is then referred to as a child in need of care.
So I think one can include the provision to say that home affairs may not return a foreign child unless they have consulted with social development first. And I also don't think one would be able to include a blanket provision to say no foreign child who is a victim of trafficking should be repatriated, because you might find an instance where social development has investigated the circumstances of a child and the child can be returned to his or her parents who might not have been involved in the trafficking of the child. So if it is safe for the child to be returned, the child should be allowed to go back.
Basically, look, if we were to say a foreign child may not be repatriated, a foreign child who is a victim of trafficking may not be repatriated to his or her country of origin or the country from which he's been trafficked without giving due considerations to. Why can't we say that? Why do we have to specify that, e.g. social development?
In the section regarding whether it's safe or not safe, so that's covered.
Do you see what you're saying?
Okay, so would the committee like us in to take out the words the Director General of Social Development might not, and then
I thought I was happy with without consulting the DG Social Development, because if we just say safe, who determined the safe?
DG of Social Development. That's what he does.
But in terms of movement of a child,
yeah.
The DG of Social Development cannot take responsibility. It will be the DG of Home Affairs.
Well, the DG of Social Development will go to the DG of Home Affairs and says, I want to send this child back.
Yeah.
DG of Social Development can't go to the airport and put the child on a plane. He doesn't have the authority to do that.
They do.
Do they?
Yeah.
They do.
That's what they're going to do.
Oh, okay.
The social worker will go with the child to the overseas destination. Home Affairs will facilitate the travel documentation. That's how I understood this to be.
Well, yes, Social Development will go to Home Affairs and says, please facilitate travel documents. That's what I meant.
Yeah. But
you can't just take the child to the airport.
No.
I mean,
yeah.
You've got to need draw travel documents. That's what I meant.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, because I like the way she put it, because it guarantees that indeed so the DG social development will be involved. But if we just say unless it is safe, who will determine the safety? The Home Affairs people are not determining the safety.
Maybe if this is already in the Children's Act, and it's been there for how many years? Let's leave it as it is.
So don't change anything.
Leave it as social development. Well, I think it's a bit of a contorted route, but probably Children's Act is a child can't be repatriated unless there's a social worker going with them, and the social worker is under the DG of social development, so they can't be repatriated. But then I think just given the sensitivities from Home Affairs that the B and the sub 3 should come out. I mean, they're not particularly necessary.
Thirty-one one B, right?
You know that they B1 is that they must they can request Home Affairs to issue travel documents if they are going to repatriate. I mean, Home Affairs will love to do that because they want to get rid of people. And two is applying for permits if they're not going to repatriate them. And then the adult one, 31.3, is applying for travel documents if they're not. I mean, it's implied. I just prefer the these provisions being in the bill as it went through cabinet for various reasons. You know, so it's basically the restriction is a child victim may not be repatriated without having considered these things. We don't then specify what happens. We just say they can't be repatriated. That's what the introduced bill said. Same with an adult. An adult can't be repatriated. That's it. They can work out what to do with the people.
Understand the rationale, because if we put that in, this bill is going to be delayed further in the NCLP process, where you're going to have Home Affairs then coming there and objecting to these provisions, saying it's not in the introduced bill, and we're going to have another 6 to 9 months delay. This way it leaves it open, although whether it's desirable or not, the question arises, what is the status of those people then? And then it is open. But a very serious concern about possible further delays, and I think that's what Honourable Jeffries is referring to.
I'm concerned. I mean, I think B1 will probably be covered by the other legislation, but B2 concerns me if we take that out, because if there's a child and the decision is made not to repatriate, and there's no obligation on somebody to apply on behalf of the child, then what's going to happen?
Well, the child falls under social development, and the status, both the child and the adult,
status would have to be sorted out in terms of existing law.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, he's a child. Yeah. So, what is it we're doing?
Taking out B. The whole of 311B and 313.
So, the whole of B, Roman 1 and 2.
Yeah.
Okay.
What about the issue of travel documents? Home Affairs will be very happy to get rid of a child, and I'm sure we'll find a way to issue travel documents.
Alright, so B1 and B and what else? Sorry.
B and 313.
3. Comes out too?
Yes.
Okay. That
Yes, thank you, sir. I also think that with regard to this whole matter of what will happen to the child, if we put in the old clause 43, as I previously indicated, that might take care of that, because the children's court order will be
don't have children floating around. Okay. Where next? Mrs. Stay?
48. I can see them together. I've got a colored one. So.
Oh, okay.
On page 48, the situation of the victim of trafficking to the Republic, look at clause 53, actually on page 59, the Roman 5 there, and with regard to, we had previous discussions when it was decided that the words to an accredited organization must come out so that the adult victim of trafficking will only be referred to the Provincial Department of Social Development. I think in previous discussions it was said that the logistics of where the adult person should be dealt with outside of the scope of this bill. But it is a major concern to us whether we're not creating a gap in this instance, because the child victim must be referred to a child protection organization or the Provincial Department of Social Development, but the adult person not.
Look, I mean, the children require more care. I mean, here I don't think there's a gap because the Provincial Department of Social Development is responsible. The problem that we're trying to avoid is that if you have that they can be referred to an accredited organisation, then you might have huge numbers of people who have not necessarily been trafficked. And the accredited organizations can then claim funds from government for looking after these people. I mean, I know it is Home Affairs that are doing it. It's the DG of Home Affairs that must do this, but I don't know, I suppose if it's a DG of Home Affairs, then I suppose it does limit it. It would be the customs officials, the border police, I mean, the border officials. They can't sort of just walk in. But I mean, there isn't technically a gap because it's Provincial Department of Social Development.
They could be internally referred to.
Yeah.
On page 50, clause 37, international cooperation. You see there's footnote 66 with regard to subclause 2, an agreement referred to in subsection 1 may not be in conflict with the provisions of the United Nations Protocol to prevent, suppress or punish trafficking in persons. It was decided earlier that we're not going to touch the protocol as a schedule any longer. The question arises whether the same situation would not arise with regard to international agreements. The site could be open to litigation if anything in the bill is inadvertent in conflict with the provisions of the protocol. And the question then arises whether we should not provide that an agreement may not be in conflict with the provisions of this bill.
Mm-hmm. Secretariat of State's not covered by the protocol. Okay? So it's saying that the President may enter into agreement with well, states, sorry, that's A. And it so it's international, it's an international treaty. Surely it can't be in conflict with our domestic law, an international agreement. And presumably this clause has come from the Palermo Protocol, hasn't it? Basically saying it's empowering our president to enter into treaties with states not part of the protocol, and we're saying that they those agreements then can't be in conflict with the protocol. It's no with the protocol, okay? Because it's an international. It's an agreement referred to may not be in conflict with the provisions of the UN protocol. I mean, I would argue that surely no foreign agreement can be entered into that's in conflict with our law. So I don't think I don't see the point in saying it may not be in conflict with this act. What it is saying is it's apples and apples. We've now got an agreement with, I don't know who's not part of Palermo, Iraq. Is that what you found out yesterday? You've now got an agreement with country A, which is not part of the protocol. You've got another international treaty, and you're saying that treaty can't be in conflict with this protocol, with Palermo. Then you've got another country which is a party to Palermo, and you can't renegotiate, like with the Americans, to say we're not going to extradite people. I don't know if there's extra provision. So I would have thought it needs to be apples and apples. In other words, international treaty and international treaty, as in Palermo Protocol, rather than apple and pear, international treaty and our law. So I don't see a problem with the way it is at the moment, but surely this has come from the Palermo Protocol, hasn't it? I don't know if you've still got a copy of it.
I see the same provision is in the Children's Act. It was just we got it from the Children's Act, in which the reference is made to the protocol and not to the Children's Act. So I think we could leave it like this.
All right.
Yes.
So that could not come back.
With regard to subclause 4, the provisions there that have been strike through, are the provisions that was in the discussion of the working document before the committee on the 7th of December, and then it was decided that the wording should change. You will see I've got a footnote there, 77. So up to there, it was the wording as on 7th of December. The part following there on with the double strike through was the part that was inserted in the working document that was forwarded to the committee on the 12th of January. But unfortunately, when I read it again, it looked as if there was a part amiss. You will see on page 67, footnote 78, this wording has been brought into line with subclause 1, which was approved by the committee on 7th of December. Some provisions have been omitted from the working document circulated on the 12th of January. According to previous versions, the matters indicated in A and G, that is on page 67, relate to the kind of information that must be collected and analysed. The Home Affairs must only issue directives relating to the collection and analysis of information, and therefore I have redrafted this part, and I will just have the committee's guidance on that. So what has been put in is issue directives regarding the collection and analysis of information on victims of trafficking who have been repatriated from the Republic in terms of Section 31, victims who have been repatriated to the Republic in terms of Section 33 relating to, and then ITG will follow. On page 73, clause 49, transitional arrangement, you will see footnote 83. That is, we have inserted, we suggested the insertion of that subclause that criminal proceedings instituted in terms of any law in respect of conduct which constitutes an offence provided for in Chapter 2, but which were instituted prior to the commencement of this act must be continued and concluded as if this act had not been passed, for the reason that currently, maybe current
Definitely, that's one of the reasons.
Yeah.
Okay.
Does
it cover the different things? Yes. Yes. So we remove footnote 83 and 84. Okay.
Mr. T, and then we still have to deal with the schedule with regard to the laws repealed or amended.
What you have to deal with is two weeks later.
Can I proceed with the schedule? With regard to the Prescription Act, and this will also relate to many of the other amendments, we have inserted a provision and an alleged offence as provided for in Section 4, 5 and 7 and involvement in these offences as provided for in Section 10 of the Trafficking Act. And I have also, throughout the schedule, changed the numbering of the Act of 2012. The reason for providing for Section 10 is because Section 71(1) of the Sexual Offences Act deals with the offence of trafficking in persons for sexual purposes, and Section 71(2) deals with the offence of involvement in trafficking. But it does not provide for any other traffic-related offences as we provide in this bill. The offence of involvement in trafficking in persons in Clause 10 covers all the other offences in Chapter 2 and not only trafficking in persons. And that is why we suggest the insertion of Section 10 there as well.
Okay. Any objections, honourable members?
No.
That footnote comes out.
On page 75, now with the Criminal Procedure Act, on top of page 75, we inserted sections 4, 5, and 7. The footnote says, the bill has introduced refers only to clause 4. But we suggest that consideration be given to include clause 5. Debt bondage and clause 7 using the services of the offences in respect which provide the institute the institution will not lack.
Okay, honourable members? Good, right. Does that mean the other 50 are
going to come out? It will come out there.
Okay, good, so 86, 87,
88. And then? We will also insert after section 251 of the Criminal Procedure Act, that's on page 75, trafficking in persons, which would then deal with the evidence on the charge of that those offences. Does not prove that offence, but other offences that the court could found. On page 78, there's a suggestion that section 299A of the Criminal Procedure Act be amended by including section 299 deals with the right of complainant to make representations in certain matters with regard to placement on parole and so on. To include offences of trafficking, debt bondage, using the services of a victim, and then also a clause 10 that we refer to that in section 299A.
Agreed.
On page 79, number 4, Schedule 1 deals with the offences in respect of which arrests can be made without a warrant. And there, what we basically did is just to indicate that trafficking in persons as provided for in section 4 and involvement in the offence as provided for in section 10. Should be added. With regard to the amendment of part 2, the same, we suggest that offences provided for in section 4, 5, and 7 and involvement be added. The amendment of part 3 of schedule 2 for the insertion of offences as provided for in section 4, 5, and 7 and involvement. The amendment of Schedule 5 also. Offences as provided for in Section 4, 5, 7, and 9.1. 9.1 provides for the offence by a carrier. There's another offence in 9.1 dealing with the making the offence not to report, which should not. The added here. The amendment of Schedule 6, also by the insertion of reference to Section 4, 5, and 7. coming to the Criminal Law Amendment Act on page 81. The amendment of Part 1 of Schedule 2 of Criminal Law Amendment Act, also by indicating that the trafficking persons offence in Section 4.1. This is the act dealing with the minimum sentencing, so we're referring to 4.1. 4.2 is the forced marriage or adoption of a child for purposes of exploitation do not fall under this, under the Minimum Sentencing Act. We delete in Part 3 of the schedule the reference to a trafficking related to things by a commercial carrier, because in terms of our bill, it will not fall under the Minimum Sentencing Act. The Witness Protection Act, also a reference to any of the things under Chapter 2 in that annexure. Prevention of Organized Crime Act, amendment of Schedule 1 by referring to any offence under Chapter 2 of the Prevention and Combat of this Act. I might add here, if you have a look on page 82, footnote 97, that the NPA suggested that we could refer to all the offences. The Private Security Industry Regulation Act, we also refer to any offence under Chapter 2 except for 9.3, which is the failure to report a victim of a suspected victim of trafficking. In the Immigration Act, on page 83, footnote 99, we originally had an amendment of section 27, but due to all the previous discussions following Home Affairs, that was taken out. And we only amend section 29 by the insertion of subsection 1A, and the amendment of section 35.
Are we okay with all those honorable amendments?
The amendment of section 49, we also add a reference in subsection 15.
Yes. On immigration, the HSA, the footnote that says that the policy indicated that it refers, it prefers refugee approach instead of permanent residence approach. How has that been dealt with? Is it because the warrant actually indicates that permanent residence will be provided, has actually been modified for a specific period? Does it then take care of it?
Okay. So do we take out footnotes 99 and 100? Okay.
Page 84.
Is that
okay? That was amendment that we did as suggested by Home Affairs at the meeting of 15th of November.
Okay.
with the amendment of section 49, the adding a paragraph C. On page
87.
Right. Then on page 87, the amendment of Schedule 1. We substitute the reference to the Sexual Offences Act to the any offence under Chapter 2, except Section 9.3, which has had any kind of deal with the failure to report it, victim of trafficking. In the Children's Act, we delete in the table of contents the reference to the Chapter 18. In Section 1 of the Children's Act, we substitute the definition of commercial sexual exploitation. We repeal the definitions of trafficking and United Nations Protocol to Prevent Trafficking in Persons. In the body of the Act, we repeal Chapter 18. And we amend Section 305 by the repeal of those sections.
Okay.
305 of the Children's Act deals with the offences. We repeal subsection 8 of section 308. On page 89, the criminal law sexual offences and related matters, for some reason, the Support Amendment Act was omitted. And then in that act, we amend the long title by the deletion of that part, making interim provision relating to the trafficking in persons for sexual purposes. We amend the index for the deletion in Chapter 7, Part 6. We amend Section 1 for the substitution for the definition of sexual offense, and then we add, we take out the reference to the Sexual Offenses Act, the 71. Dealing with trafficking,
mm-hmm.
and we add an any offence referred to in Chapter 2 of the Prevention and Combating of Trafficking in Persons Act, which was committed for sexual purposes.
Okay.
We delete in Chapter 7 the heading of Part 6, and then we repeal Section 70 and 71. The Child Justice Act, there is an amendment of Schedule 3. By also replacing the reference to the Sexual Offences Act with any offence provided for in Sections 4, 5, 6 or 7 or involvement in these offences as provided for in Section 10 of this Act.
So straightforward. Okay, if you have laughed.
And they check, otherwise we need a general provision. Any signature that not covered.
The court must use its discretion.
I'm sure we have covered, but we will really check that.
Alright, okay. Yes, we flagged that.
Yeah.
And given that we flagged it, should we wait until the next meeting? And then...
Yeah, we can't, I think we're in a position now.
Do we need a clean bill to go through? And I think, Chair, we do need to actually... I don't know how long it would take us, but we do need to go through it. It is a complex bill. I think we do need a fresh look at it, so it's not like a 5-minute approval.
Yeah.
But that's how we're going through.
Can we ask Mrs. Stain then to take out all the footnotes, those that we've covered? We've agreed that we would flag that one issue raised by Ms. Schaefer. We acknowledge that. But otherwise, give us a clean bill so that we go through it once more.
so that when we meet again, which will be on Tuesday, yes, then we should be in a position to decide whether we're going to deal with it formally or not.
And is there any that the U.S. experts will have just in
case? Yes.
Is there any oversight or anything?
Yeah.
Have you checked if anything is
happening? Right. What else do we have? What are the members?
Provision of the program.
We'll chair for 2 weeks today.
Hey, YouTube got minus to school. All right. If that's it, then it's just for me to say thank you to Spain and the rest of the team. I'm pretty confident that the next time we meet will be to consider the bill formally. Yeah. Right. Then that's it. Thank you.